Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the sixth of our weekly Teneo Insights calls on the impact of COVID-19. The novelty is definitely over. Certainty still reigns, but I'm sure another strong panel can help us make sense of it all. Today, we've got Humphrey Cobbold, who is the CEO of PureGin, and he'll be talking to us about decisions his business is taking now and going forward. So David Dalton is the former CEO of Salford Royal NHS Foundation Trust. He'll offer his expert view on the implications of COVID-19 for the NHS. Amber Rudd, who's a regular on this, who's a Teneo senior advisor and former Home Secretary, will analyse the political situation in the UK and abroad. And Wolfgang O'Piccoli, Teneo's Director of Research, analyse trends in handling COVID-19 around the world. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. I can hear a couple of you aren't on mute, so please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please put your questions in there. In the second half of the call, I'm going to put them to the panel. Ideally, let me know your name and which business you're representing. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. So that done, let's get straight to it. And Amber Rudd, I'd like to begin with you. The UK government seems to be in a bit of limbo and struggling with a lot of questions this week. Is that fair?
Hello, Craig. Yes, I'm afraid to say that is fair. The UK government really is in the same position as most other governments at the moment, now facing the reality of some very difficult choices. The original proposals that the UK government put in place to protect businesses were really intended to do one important thing, which was to buy time. When they were put in place in the first place, nobody was really looking the other side. They were just thinking, how do we stabilise this in order to plan to move to the next stage? The pieces that they put in place have been effective in terms of keeping unemployment down. But as the Chancellor and the rest of the Treasury are now discovering, it's a hugely expensive initiative, the furloughing. It was estimated to cost less than 10 billion when they originally put it together, and now the estimates are it's beyond 30 billion. Chancellor's extended it to cover June. And here is the dilemma. How does he end the furloughing, allowing people to go back to work, unless those businesses that they've come from are operating again and making the profits necessary to pay people? In order for those businesses to reopen, there has to be an exit strategy and an exit proposal in place. Now, I know government doesn't want us to talk about the word exit at all. They see it as a stage managed exit, one step at a time. But there is here a fundamental problem, which I think is causing the paralysis, is if you want to stop spending these epic sums of money by the state effectively employing so many people, have to have jobs for them to go back to. There has to be a clear plan so that the factories reopen, the shops reopen, the restaurants reopen. And at the moment, there is a total absence of that. So it feels very much in the UK that there is an increasingly rustling uncertainty and dissatisfaction with the government. Government is supposed to give us a certain amount of hope, but we need a bit more truth as well. And ministers every day who come and do those conferences are now running into regular difficulties where, quite frankly, they're saying one thing, which is then being contradicted, whether it's on the supplies of protective equipment to the healthcare, to care workers, to the hospitals, and maybe we'll hear more of that from David, or whether it's on whether they have entered into the sharing mechanism with the EU, where there was some confusion yesterday. The growing confusion is unsustainable, evidently, for more than a week or 2 weeks. It seems that Boris is going to be coming back soon. Quite wisely, I have to say, he's not making a full reappearance yet, but the rumour is that he's now sort of out and about, talking a bit, engaging a bit. So I think by next week, we will see some more planning, which they will start revealing to us. I just don't see how this endless silence can be maintained. For one thing, it's toe-curling to listen to the ministers who are sent out every morning with nothing more to say. And if the government want to give us hope, they do need to make sure that Boris returns and tries to do that. So that's obviously the next stage where I would expect that to go to. One other point, if I may. I spoke to one senior minister at some length yesterday who was saying that one of the things they are discussing and remain very much committed to is the zero carbon achievement for 2050. That's relevant because when we came out of the financial crisis in 2008-9, it was difficult to maintain that as a key agenda. But we do expect that to remain a key agenda, which at least will give a vehicle, amongst other things, for the additional infrastructure spending that's going to be necessary to deliver a fiscal stimulus. I had said before, and I still expect, the Treasury to review the COVID interruption loans, which were only pegged at an 80% guarantee from the Treasury. Now, Andrew Bailey, the governor, has called for that as well to go to 100%. I still find it perplexing that the Treasury is holding out against that, given so few of them are getting through. The method seems to be announce it, test it and see. I'm still hopeful, although I may be hoping against hope because I know the Chancellor said he wasn't going to revise it, but that SMEs are really struggling to access the loans. If this period goes on and that isn't extended to the 100%, then I would expect to see a considerably more difficulties for that sector of business. Thank you.
Thank you, Amber. That was fascinating. And we're getting some questions already coming through on the chat function. So please continue to put those in as we go forward. I'm going to come to you now, Humphrey Cobold. Your business, PureGym, has been in the front line of dealing with COVID-19, with social distancing and the lockdown directly impacting your gyms. Tell us about that, where you are and where you see the future.
Yeah, sure. Good morning, Craig. I think that's certainly true. We can't claim to be in the front line of healthcare in the UK, but we're certainly in the front line of the business environment in terms of what is going on. Very brief context, we're a budget gym operator. We operate 270 sites in the UK, another 250 or so across Europe in Denmark, Switzerland and Poland, about 7,000 people in total employed in the group, 24/7 operations typically. Many people would call us a no-frills operator, no swimming pools, no Turkish baths, nothing of that sort of nature. Average price is about £20 a month, so very much the affordable end of things, and focused really on democratising fitness and activity in the UK, Denmark, Switzerland and other countries where we operate. But we're a disruptor turned leader. We're the largest player in the UK, the second largest in Europe, and that's the reason we've built over 10 years. The Prime Minister gave us 10 hours to close it down 2 or 3 weeks ago to put a kind of gloss on the difficulties we faced. Yeah, we took a business that was turning over 500 million just a few weeks ago on an annual basis to a business that's now got zero revenues and was burning cash between £9 and £10 million a week. You do at moments like that, stare in the mirror and ask yourself, what on earth am I going to do next with this? It's that sort of moment. So what did we do? Well, we got out there and did the closure as quickly as we could. We were closed down by 8 o'clock on the morning after the Prime Minister asked us to enact that decision. A similar basis in Denmark and Switzerland, actually a few days earlier, so we knew what was coming. We focused a lot of effort and attention on looking after the people side of our business. We'd been very focused on our members up until that point as well. We'd introduced new cleaning and setup regimes in the gyms, so that they could remain open for as long as possible. So we'd done all that. But we had to deal with communications internally with our staff, many of whom, for understandably, were extremely nervous, extremely anxious about what the future held for them. And clearly, I've got a bunch of investors who are in shock as well. I've got bond investors. I've got investors in our debt who provided a bridge facility for us to do an acquisition at the end of last year. And I've also got my main equity investors who are an extremely a good set of investors. We're very fortunate from the US who've been supporting us throughout this, but you have to spend a lot of time communicating with those investors. And 5 days after we closed down, we had to go out to our bond investors and explain how we were going to get our burn rate down from the £9 to £10 million figure to a figure of between probably four and a half or five, which gives us, given we've got reasonable liquidity in hand, a period of time which we can get through this a crisis and get to the other side. We took the decision early on that we were going to, backed by the government furlough scheme that Amber referred to, which I have to say has been excellent, although very costly for the government, that we were going to endeavour to get through this without making anybody redundant. That involved taking full advantage of the government furlough scheme domestically in the UK and Denmark, Switzerland and Poland, and we've got about 7,300 people on furlough out of about 7,450 people in total in the group, so the extensive use of furlough. We've also asked pretty much everybody in the group to take a degree of salary sacrifice, whether part of the furlough scheme or those who are still working. We felt it was important that the difficulties should be shared pretty well across people. And in general, I have to say, it's been extraordinary, the response of people, our team, and actually our members in many cases as well, to what we've done. They're incredibly supportive. We took the decision right on closing to not try and draw any more direct debits from our members. Ours is a no-contracted model anyway, so people can resign their membership anytime they want to. We don't force people to sign up for a period of time. And so we took the decision not to take more money from people. So that's how we ended up in a almost entirely zero revenue basis. Of course, we've had to think about the external communications as well, and we actually took a decision quite early on to do something we hadn't done previously, which is to step out and communicate externally in the media much more about what we were going through and what we were doing. We felt that was important for us to have a voice. We felt it important for business from our sector to have a voice, and we're one of the obvious leaders to do that. We also felt that we could play a constructive role in engaging with government. And in general, I have to say they've endeavoured, amongst many other things, to listen well to the concerns that have been raised. And we maintain a dialogue with them, both through our industry association and directly. We went beyond the norm, though, and I ended up doing more interviews really in a 3 or 4 week period than I've probably done in 5 years as chief executive. With BBC on the radio, I was on Question Time 2 or 3 weeks ago, and numerous sort of press-related interviews to make sure that the voice of our business specifically, but our sector generally and more generally business impacted by this, is being heard clearly. That's had some direct benefits to us because it has helped us create connections into government, which has been useful, but I think it's had a good spin-off benefit for us as well, in that it's reassured people within my business that we're important enough to get the attention of people out there. That's been a very important aspect of it. And I think I've been out there hopefully suggesting positively ways in which we can think about managing things better with landlords through the flow scheme. And then actually, as we are now doing, looking at reopening. 70% of my time and effort now is looking to the future. How do we reopen? What are the protocols that government will set for that? How will we manage consumer response? How will we communicate with people? And how will we reflate the business and play our role in reflating the economy, which is going to be so desperately needed once we come through the severest of this lockdown? I would agree with the sense that a simple exit strategy is a misnomer. I think we have to get used to a more progressive, nuanced and progressive mechanism from getting away from where we are now. I suspect it's going to take many months rather than many weeks to do that. We're certainly preparing ourselves as an organisation to do that. And that's not without its practical challenges. You know, where do you find thermometers that you can measure people's temperatures with? I've got 35 containers of paper to be used for swabbing down gym equipment with antibacterial spray, getting onto the water out of Asia Pacific to come across to the UK so that when we reopen, hopefully in 6 or 8 weeks, we'll be able to provide the sanitary and hygienic environment that will be necessary. The scale of the requirement for these things when you're a large group is really quite significant. And this is all in a world where China has locked down on exports and lots of things that we would want to get access to. As we know, the NHS quite correctly has first call on pretty much any supplies or products sort of nature in warehouses or in a situation in the UK currently. So there are very practical considerations to how we relaunch and reflate our business over the months when we're allowed to start to do that. And of course, one of the things we're grappling with is when that might happen and how it might happen. And the government currently giving no indication of that, I'd have to say, it is not helpful. We understand they can't be defined about that, but it certainly would be very helpful if they could start to provide just a little bit more shape to the possible future, even if it has to change, that is better than having no idea at all. So overall, in summary, it's been a pretty fascinating last 6 to 8 weeks. They don't prepare you at business school or anywhere else for anything like this. It's been 6 or 8 weeks unlike any other, and I'm happy to take any sort of questions or points of view that people have on this.
Thank you, Humphrey. I think fascinating feels like a great euphemism to me, but well done and thank you. We really appreciate it, and we'll come to some questions a bit later. But I'm going to move on to Sir David Dalton now, who's a health expert. David is going to be on audio only just because of technical issues we've been having. But David, if you unmute yourself, the health and the NHS is front and centre, obviously, at the moment. Lots of evidence of problems. What's your predictions for the health service and how things are going?
Thank you. Can I just check you can hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Yes, so when the crisis passes, I think there's a big question about what the NHS will do, whether it will revert to its old ways of doing things or use the experience to act differently. So I really want you to join me in peering into the fog and having a look at some of the shapes that we might be able to see. And as Amber has said, I mean, we have to start by acknowledging the government's huge spending, unprecedented amounts to secure levels of income for citizens, and also to support the vital services and infrastructure of the country. And I think the public are largely accepting the government's instructions, and there is this real sense of collectivism and community washing over the country. And I think no more so than the heartfelt emoting for the NHS. So we see every day, protect our NHS is at the heart of the government's message, with frontline staff being held in such reverence, demonstrated by the weekly applause heard across the nation. But, and it is a big but, I think the NHS will soon need to address some massive challenges. There is a huge backlog of waiting times and waiting lists. It already stood in excess of 5 million people, the highest figure for 15 years. That is going to be substantially inflated by people who are not attending hospital now. Already numbers look quite significant. There's the backlog of estate maintenance with some real concerns about fragility of engineering and building fabric. There's the backlog of historic debt with limited understanding of how any write-off announced by the Secretary of State will really work. And then there's the backlog of staff annual leave and time owed and the consequences of their physical and mental exhaustion. And it's my view that I think this intensity of public emotion for the NHS will change. It will wane and be displaced by some sense of post-crisis frustration that more has to be done to address those challenges and backlogs that I mentioned. And it may become very hard for the government to convince people that there isn't a money tree to shake. I also think that the public sympathy for NHS and other low-paid public sector workers may drive trades unions to pursue a new contract for NHS staff. And that's not to question the economic realities of the affordability of that. It's just to say that the any demands that the government makes for restraint, I think, are going to be received differently now. In effect, a new dynamic will be in play. A few other things that have become quite noticeable, and that is that the crisis has highlighted the key dependency on social care and has revealed its current inadequacies. Now, it was already teetering on the edge before the virus, and now it risks implosion. And yet, I think the crisis may create a new space for a political consensus to emerge for a long-term settlement to ensure resilience for not only for us now, but for the next generation. And I sincerely hope so. There's the challenge that NHS procurement practice has, and it's exposing some of the fragility of the supply chain. Some of the just-in-time pull arrangements that were in place, and questions are rightly being asked of global dependence, reshoring manufacturing, and having higher levels of stock holding. Now, I think that there will be a new equilibrium that will be achieved, but I also see huge opportunities to build on what's happening, which is the collaboration that's being seen and the agility within our universities and manufacturers working with NHS customers. And these arrangements I see are driving innovation and adoption. So, you know, the issue of new style ventilators, I think, is a good example. And it's clear that this energy must not be lost in the future. Now, much has been said, and much of it is true, about the NHS now being awash with transformative digital changes. What we've experienced in the last couple of months is that 95% of primary care activity is now being delivered online. Video triage and home testing and remote monitoring by smartphones have become quite commonplace. And in a single week, thousands of delivered devices are connecting people in care homes. 1.5 million vulnerable people are being connected by text, and Babylon's app has been accessed by about 300,000 people. So what would have taken years to introduce has been done in a matter of weeks. And so this change in public interaction with the NHS is going to, I think, grow and be a reality, with fewer attendances at GP surgeries and hospital clinics, and there'll certainly be less use of car parks. Service models are changing too, and you can see this already in the last couple of months, with new models for cancer care being separated from general acute receiving hospitals. Prenatal care is now being undertaken by video assessment, and primary care by our GPs and other practitioners are being networked across much larger geographies. There's also been a new relationship with the independent sector, which is providing much needed additional capacity. So I can't see these developments reverting back to the previous status quo. A couple of other things. The NHS experience of its workforce is changing too. Many are now, like I am, contributing from home. Staffing and skill mix ratios have been reblended, and staff are being retrained into roles which I think past demarcations wouldn't have permitted. And what is staggering is that with this greater flexibility, it's being reported that the NHS COVID response is now being delivered by 10% fewer staff. And so I think this, coupled with the investment that's being made into some of those automated substitute, poses a real question about how staff will be reabsorbed after the crisis. My final point is that the NHS is being governed at the moment differently. Command is centralised through local cells, area care systems and regions. And NHS organisations like mine, Foundation Trust, is accepting a level of control which previously would have been resisted. So when these local command cells are closed, what's going to take their place? Now, I've been advocating for some time, and I do hope that hospital group structures will emerge to take responsibility for multiple organisations and allow the development of more standardised operating models to assure that care is delivered to a common high standard, eliminating variation wherever you can, and being able to deliver that at a lower cost. So in conclusion, I think a lot has been asked of the NHS in the last couple of months, and I think it has risen to the challenge. But in doing so, it's also revealed its fragilities. And yet there's been so much energy and innovation and kindness which has been shown. I guess the real test for the NHS is whether it's going to learn from its experiences of this crisis and become more agile, adaptive and welcoming of change.
Okay, David, that was incredibly helpful. Thank you. Just remind people that the chat function on the top right-hand side of your screen allows you to ask some questions. I'm going to come to Wolf Pickerly next. The lockdowns seem to be easing in some countries. Is that something we can take some comfort from, Wolf?
To a certain extent, I would be very careful about that. Maybe we can start from China, as usually we do in these calls. Well, this week we had the worst outbreak for the last month in Harbin, northeast China. The authorities intervened quite quickly. They imposed the current lockdown again. Again, it was blamed on the return from abroad of a Chinese student. The same happened last week, as you might remember, at the border between China and Siberia. There is also a feeling that in Beijing, the authorities are in high alert for more imported cases. Maybe that is because the Communist Party is supposed to have its major plenum that was delayed. So they are trying to create a safe environment in Beijing. But if you are coming from other parts of China and you go to Beijing, you have a 14 days quarantine imposed on you. And also on that, we have rumors that this weekend, they're going to shut down gyms, sport facilities, swimming pools in Beijing. So even in China, the situation remains still kind of rather murky, let's put it in that way. In terms of Europe, so the bottom line here is that we got lots of talk about exit strategy, which we know is a misnomer. But still, the reality here is that no country has been able to put together a policy of testing, tracing and tracking that can be scaled up very significantly in Europe and anywhere else. So the last line of defense remains social distancing. What is also interesting in terms of the key economies in continental Europe, so France, Italy, Germany, the Netherlands and Spain, as soon as we started the debate on exit strategy, things got complicated, they got political. And we have seen that forcing government to adapt their strategy, their approach. They received quite a bit of pushback, and in some cases, they've been forced to do some U-turns. So, and in our view, the issue of exit strategy goes beyond the usual social political cleavages that political parties are familiar with. They are beyond ideologies, and that is why governments are struggling to put together effective exit strategies. Timelines. Generally speaking, when we look at the countries I just listed, we are talking about something between the 4th of May and 11th of May. In some cases, like Germany, France, and the Netherlands, we have some initial contours of exit strategies. In the case of Italy and Spain, we are still waiting for announcement. In the case of Italy, we might get something by the end of this week. There is also already a very intense debate about the usage of application to do contact tracing. In Italy, they're already creating groups on Facebook against the usage of application for privacy reasons. In France, Macron has promised a parliamentary debate on the application, but not a vote, and that has created quite a bit of uproar in the French National Assembly. There is also recrimination and investigation have started in Italy. For example, they're investigating on what has been happening in Lombardy. Multiple prosecutors have opened cases and recrimination even in France, where there is a feeling that the government in Paris underplayed the usefulness of masks simply because they didn't have them available. So I suspect we're going to see more and more of these coming over the next few weeks in a variety of other countries. In terms of the other area of dispute is between regional entities, local administration and central governments. In the case of Italy, for example, in Lombardy and Veneto, which account for around 30% of GDP of the country, the regional governors are threatening to take unilateral decision and to reopen for business, while the government is asking for a more careful consideration there. So these kind of disputes, again, undermine the ability to put together a coordinated effort. And in terms of Spain, talking about U-turns, children in Spain have been forced in since mid-March. The government announced yesterday they were going to be allowed out as long as they were together with one of the parents, but only to go to supermarkets and pharmacies. This has created a huge uproar, and now the government, in less than 24 hours, they've been forced to change the whole policy. So the bottom line here is that if businesses are expecting clear guidelines. These are unlikely to come. Guidelines will be susceptible to change. The issue is extremely controversial. And still, when we look at opinion polls, the public still is fairly uneasy about reopening. Public health, protecting the NHS in the case of the UK, they still seem to be the main priority despite the heavy economic costs that Amber highlighted in her intervention earlier. And let me pause there to see whether we have any question. Thank you.
Thanks, Wolf. There's lots in there. And just to remind people about the questions on the chat function, let's start with Neil Addison. I'm going to come to you in a moment on this one, Humphrey, but first, Amber. Neil from Unique Window System is saying, do you think the UK will adopt the US phasing style to plan the return to the country to work?
I think phasing is the only way that it can be done. And I very much endorse what Wolf has just said about government sort of doing it in a way, sort of trial and error. But it's just all countries, I feel, at the moment are sort of watching nervously, looking over their shoulders. So they will certainly watch what happens in the US and see if it does work. And the great thing about the US is that different states are doing different things. So there's a panoply of different options to watch there.
And Humphrey, this must be incredibly relevant to you about when your workers are allowed back and when your customers are allowed to come in. Do you have a strong view on that or a sense of when that could be?
Correct. So my observations based both on the UK, but also Denmark and Switzerland in particular, where we have businesses, is that there will be two types of phasing, I think, possibly three. There'll be a phasing of which sectors are allowed to open at all at various stages. Switzerland has a four-phased approach, Denmark a three-phased approach currently. The UK doesn't have any approach as far as I can tell at the moment. And secondly, once a sector is soft reopened, as people are describing it, what protocols might evolve.
We just seem to have lost you for a second there, Humphrey. So try one more time. Okay, let's come back to you. I'll let you play with your things, and then we'll see what we can come back to. But David, if you could unmute yourself at the moment. We're getting a lot of people talking about Germany doing better than the UK at the moment. They obviously have a very different health system, but at the moment there's a sense in which there can be no challenge to the NHS because it's become even more exalted. Do you see that as an issue, that other countries appear to be doing better, yet we're not able to actually ask questions of our health service?
Well, I think there are different experiences in different places, and I think one of the one of the great things about the English healthcare system is that it's not only universal, but the way everybody is registered on it, it allows people like Public Health England the ability to ask people to do things and collect information and to organise what will inevitably, and the sooner the better, happen, which is testing and to really understand the spread or the control of the virus. But I reflect on many other places around the world. I mean, we know that Italy is experiencing unprecedented demand on its health service, and much of the commentary that I've been reading and folk that I've been talking to suggest that hospitals, because they're quite isolated, not part of a common system, are either sinking or swimming on their own. And the same is true in a number of other countries where there isn't an organised national system similar to that we experience in this country. And let me say it, I mean, I think that hospitals at the moment are running on occupancy levels of on average between 50 and 60% at the moment, and that is unheard of. Normal occupancy levels are in the mid-90s normally, causing difficulties and delays of people accessing hospital beds. That isn't the case now in the crisis, but we are storing up issues that we're going to have to deal with in the months to come.
And just quickly, David, that sense of delay of people waiting lists, but also people being stored up who aren't being tested for serious diseases like cancer, that kind of thing, that is a very serious worry, isn't it?
It is. I mean, the early signs that I have seen are suggesting that that people who have forms of cancer are not themselves choosing to seek assessment and treatment, which does seem odd. And also people with heart conditions, with myocardial infarction, for instance, are probably suffering the pain of that rather than seeking support or phoning for ambulance to take them to hospital. So we can see already in the numbers that are collated that there is a much lower level of access from people with these types of conditions in getting hospital treatment, and that will inevitably mean that people will either suffer, they will have some health deficit, and some may die prematurely.
That's a very bleak situation and worrying. Wolf and Amber, I'm interested in this idea of people being uneasy about the things being reopened, like schools, for example, or shopping centres or whatever. They're uneasy about it because they fear the health consequences of it. Does that not really a sign that people aren't really grasping the really serious economic impact of this? And actually, I've been speaking to a couple of people in government, and there's definitely cabinet ministers who are worried that we haven't quite understood what is coming down the track. Let's start with you, Wolf.
Possibly. On the other way around, you know, even in places like Denmark, where there is a feeling that the government has handled it well, the number of casualties was low, there are lots of parents, they are still refusing to send their children to school. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's there is that concern. I think there is also a concern that the governments have not been straightforward enough in terms of information. You continue to hear all sorts of conspiracy theories. So it's a very mixed picture. And then I think the point that was making Amber before, I agree with there. There is a dire need for the government to provide as much transparency as needed, even if at times it entails some policy changes, shift and U-turns. I think the public is angry for that. And there is a feeling, I think, still that that all this pressure for opening is coming from certain sides. In Italy, for example, there is a huge dispute between businessmen and the trade unions about this, and leaving, you know, while minimizing the risk that this could pose to human health, let's put it in that way. That's my view of the situation.
Amber?
Yes, it's a paradox, isn't it, that the support for the government, and particularly for the Prime Minister, is at epic heights. And yet people are concerned about the handling and about, even if the schools reopen, whether they will send their children there because they're concerned about it. So I think the piece that is missing, which is what I was trying to highlight before and Wolf referred to here, is the fact that the government needs to be a bit more frank about the things it does know and the things it doesn't know. And then I think public would feel a bit calmer about the choices that are going to surely be coming quite soon. But it seems to me that schools will be the first thing.
But let's just pick up on this point. I mean, when you speak to people behind the scenes in government, they say that very, very serious economic problems are coming down the track. And they say it in private, but we're not really hearing it in public, are we? And isn't that
That whole point about, you know, which the Conservative government used to say of there is no money tree, turns out we were quite wrong. There is in a situation like the one we're in. But the piece which I think the government is missing an opportunity to speak about is the health and life costs that we are encountering as a country, and every country is, by keeping people locked up. As we just heard from David, the problems that they're storing up for cancer patients is going to be terrible for people on the receiving end, or who should be on the receiving end. We've mentioned before the issue to do with domestic violence, additional deaths because of that, mental health. I think we should be hearing more of that, because ultimately, if you say to people, we'll have a weaker economy or your grandfather might die, they're going to be concerned about the health of their grandfather. So health put in that way will always come first. But the point is, there are health costs to a weak economy and there are health costs to keeping inside. That's where we should be going.
Yes, and interestingly, economists like Jim O'Neill are saying that actually that older people need to be isolated, and that is just going to have to happen until the vaccine comes and we allow other people to be out and about, accepting some of the risks there. But that's anyway, I'm just going to try Humphrey again because of the we had technical problems. Obviously, this is obviously highly relevant to you about when people can come back into your gyms. You were talking a bit about that. Have you got a sense at all from government about scenarios about reopening?
Let me check first. You can hear me. I've turned off video and things. Is that better?
We can, Humphrey.
Good. OK. To be honest, we've got no clear sense. They've indicated there's been a vague indication of somewhere between the end of May and the end of June, but that is about it. We're working on a basis, therefore, of mid-June. But really, I don't know if it's going to be mid-June, early June, or the end of July, to be quite honest.
So lots of uncertainty, which obviously causes lots of issues for your business.
Yeah, correct. And so we've just got to plan under uncertainty and be ready to act and react when we're given a clearer indication. And that's the basis on which we're proceeding. Actually, we can do a fair amount on that basis. So we're proceeding with that work. But it would certainly be helpful to know what's likely to happen when, a bit sooner rather than later.
Thank you. So, David, one of the reasons for all of this uncertainty is that there's deep concerns about there being a second or even third spike in the pandemic, and that we end up having to all be back in lockdown again and over a second and third time over the coming year. What's your sense of that, and how rightly are we to fear that? And again, is that just tough luck for the economy?
Well, look, let me say, I'm not a scientist nor a clinician, and therefore I'm probably only commentating on what I've read and understand. But it is highly likely that the virus will reemerge, and all of the effort is being on suppressing its spread, so that when that does happen, there is capacity within either hospital-based or other services to respond. And we're trying to create the time where testing will allow us to have intelligence about who has immunity and who has had the virus before. It will allow us to look at contact tracing, and it will allow time for the development of a vaccine. So I think all the commentators are agreed that what they understand about the virus is that it is likely to re-emerge again. And the important thing is suppressing its ability to transmit, which we've done successfully so far through social distancing. But time is important for the delays that we've had in getting testing in place, and the time that it takes for the development of the vaccine. Once those things are in place, then I think we can develop our responses with much, much greater confidence and get on top of the crisis.
Okay. Keep your questions coming through. We've got one here from Hannah Finer, who's from the London Electrical Vehicle Company. And she's saying, although net zero by 2050 is said to remain a priority for the UK government, we're still seeing faster uptake of EVs, where EV incentive schemes and subsidies are very strong. How do we expect government debt and expensive coronavirus support schemes to impact future government spending on encouraging EV uptake? So, Amber, I'm going to throw that at you as a former Environment Secretary of State.
Yes, thank you very much. Of course, the EVs was one of the announcements that the government did make in its run-up to the now cancelled COP. It wasn't, big enough, but it was there nevertheless. I mean, and in different times, before the virus hit us, the EV agenda was very much at the top of one of the things that government wanted to lead on, partly because, of course, the Nissan Leaf is manufactured here, and one in four electric cars that are, the questioner knows this, that are driven around Europe are manufactured in the UK. So I think it's an area that we would expect to see more ambitious government policy. I mean, frankly, the whole Conservative government previous approach to reducing the deficit, to bringing down at some stage the debt, is over. As we move out of this at some stage in our phased approach, whatever it is, I would expect to see more spending in different areas, and spending in the green agenda, which could well lead off with electric vehicles, is definitely going to be one of the recipients of that newfound support and enthusiasm.
Okay, thank you.
Craig, can I just add something on this? Because I think what is also interesting to see that in terms of urban mobility, the crisis is potentially going to be used by some mayors. I've seen already example in Rome, in Milan, in Brussels, to review a bit the local transport policy in favor of bicycles, scooters, of any kind of scooters, and so on, with the idea that also these people will be allowed to move earlier than those who are using other methods of transport. On the other way around, if you look at the Chinese experience, car sales are booming, because there is a feeling that I'm safer if I travel in my car rather than using public transport. So we got two different kind of dynamics in play here. But as far as the continental Europe is concerned, there is an attempt here to review a bit the whole public transport policy in favor of more green kind of vehicles.
Thanks, Wolf. Lots of questions about how we expect people's behavior to change. Humphrey, are you getting any sense of the willingness of people to come back into gyms when they come back? Is there any sense of any research that's been done on that? Have you got hope for the future because you understand how people will behave, or is that just an unknown?
Look, I've certainly got some hope for the future. There is some early research that's being done on people's attitude to health and well-being, and yes, extending that through into, are they going to retake up habits they had before of going to the gym, or will they all continue working out over breakfast with Joe Wicks on television? That's the sort of common question. I think in general the view is varied across countries. It's more positive in countries like Denmark, where the situation seems to have been handled better and being quite open. I think it's more negative. In general, the consumer reaction is more negative in countries like the UK, where there's a feeling that the strategy hadn't been particularly clear. But our view is we won't really know until we get a chance to reopen in some way, in some controlled way, in all probability. We'll seek to learn very quickly what the new norms are and adapt to the expectations that consumers and members have of us of that time. Some of those will be very clear. We're going to have to be super sharp on cleanliness, hygiene, sanitization, etc. That's very obvious, and we're all over that. We will learn quickly as soon as things reopen. I think most businesses will take that sort of route because it is such an unknown area.
Can you just go into that a bit about the sanity, the sanitization stuff? How are you going to do that? Are you going to have like great work wiping down of every machine?
There are a series of measures being put in place. There are standards. I mean, we're setting the standard of non-clinical health service sort of provision as the standard we aspire to, putting in much more cleaning time from our staff, a much clearer expectation on our members as well that they wipe down before and wipe down after use of equipment. We'll be separating equipment more, in the early days at least, our plan would be to take out of service quite a lot of equipment, so there's more social distancing space, appropriate social distancing space between people. So a whole range of measures that we hope will reassure people that coming to facilities like ours done in the basis that we've done everything that we can do to minimize the risk of infection and transmission.
Okay. David, lots of stuff coming through about PPE, personal protective equipment, and somebody I know who I was talking to last night was saying that they were getting stuff in from all around the world that really wasn't up to scratch. How much of a problem do you think this is? And a lot of businesses are trying to help, but they're struggling to get through the bureaucracy and the fact that that it just doesn't exist.
So I think that there are real problems, and some of those are about, it goes back to Amber's point about having trust. I think supply is erratic, and in part my sense is that people understand that there has had to be a major shift in the way procurement and distribution logistics takes place. So what was experienced before was a very much a just-in-time pull arrangement, and now it's a nationally controlled push arrangement, which sometimes means that more supplies go to where they're not actually needed, and there are fewer available where they are needed. It's going to take time for that to equalise out, and there just isn't the stock holding to allow for the peaks and troughs of that supply to be smoothed. I have no doubt that everything that NHS staff is saying is true. I have also no doubt that everything the government is saying about the amount of additional supplies being procured is true. However, there are problems with getting reliable supply, and I think if people were honest about that, then at least staff would understand that, you know, these things are difficult to put in place reliably quickly. There are lessons clearly to be learnt as well for the future.
Okay, Wolf, we've got a question here about Sweden's model. Is it calculated brilliance or a disaster waiting to strike? So you probably need to explain a little about what's going on in Sweden first.
Well, they didn't impose the lockdown. The shops are open. A variety of schools, not all, have been left open. You're not required to provide an explanation if you walk on the street and so on. And so far, the death toll is contained. Whether it is a success or not, I don't want to get into that. I think it's far too early. But in my view, the experience of Sweden is very unique, and not it's not something that can be done elsewhere for two main reasons. The culture of the country, they obey to social rules. They have this self-discipline, which is very strong. Second, the health system is brilliant. So in Sweden, they were able to do that. There is still a very lively debate in Sweden whether the strategy is correct or not. Even if a lockdown was not imposed, we have seen indicators suggesting that people were taking their own precautionary measures. For example, the usage of public transport in Stockholm was down 80% last week. But it's certainly a bit of a unique experience out there. But it's not something that can be replicated elsewhere, in my view.
Okay, that's very helpful. Okay, we've had quite a depressing call, I'm afraid to say, in terms of lots of things that are being discussed about people not getting treated, dangers for the economy. I'm going to wrap up by asking all of you to talk about reasons for optimism. And I've just noticed that David has appeared in Vision having had technical issues. So why don't we try with David and see if we can hear your reasons for optimism, and then I'll go through the rest of the panel.
So let me just test this. Can you hear me?
We can.
Fantastic. I apologise for being in a hole underneath the stairs for the programme. So optimism, I see a lot of it. I mean, let me start with what I think has been paramount, which is the amount of kindness that has exhibited itself, not only across the country for the NHS, but amongst the staff themselves. I think that there is learning also. I mentioned about procurement. There will be changes to the arrangements in the future. I don't think we will experience again what we have done in the last few weeks. I think that a lot of the examples of how you can get rapid adoption of new technology in place without having the level of bureaucracy that previously existed, with all of the, you know, the consultations and the committees and the piloting and the testing and so on that would normally take years, we can see things have been introduced in a matter of weeks. I think everything that people have said about digital transforming the NHS is actually going to take place. We will see something dramatic change in the interaction, which will mean that people can get access to opinion and prescriptions and other things in a very different way, much quicker. The use of artificial intelligence also will be supporting clinical decision makers to make more speedier decisions. But there's a mountain to climb before all of that. And whilst I'm optimistic for the future, I think that we are going to see people not getting access to services in the way that they could or should have. We will see the toll of the virus bear down on people in this intervening period. So lots of optimism about how the NHS can and will learn, but I think there is some more damage and suffering to be experienced before we get there.
So thank you for that. Humphrey, optimism?
Sure. Well, look, I mean, look, your base expectation has to be that it's going to be a long, hard climb out of the quite deep hole that we're digging for ourselves. That's the reality. But I am an optimist by nature. And I think three or four things stand out. I think we've had pretty good adherence to the rules that have been laid out. It's not perfect, but actually pretty good. I think we've seen a lot of British stoicism as well, which is a good national characteristic. We deal with things and get on with stuff. Seen quite a lot of good humour. Been plenty of memes of Donald Trump to laugh about, that's for sure. And I think there's been a really clear readiness to adapt to what's going on and to change. I think David just mentioned the application of technology and digital to the National Health Service. You're seeing that in pretty much every sector, I think. And not least of all, we're having these sort of meetings by conference call, by video call. Like this. And I think that ability to adapt is going to be absolutely essential. So, yes, I see good opportunities and reasons for optimism, but it has to be in a background of expecting quite a long, hard push from where we are today.
Amber, are you going to cheer us up?
I don't know. But just from a practical point of view, the one area that I think can no longer be ducked by any UK government is social care. And it is the area that is so depressing. And as a former MP, the amount of families I saw who were tearing their hair out, they didn't know how to handle it, they were getting a bad service, they were having to sell their houses, all those things, I think, I hope, will finally be dealt with. And this government will address it and find a solution, however expensive it is, and the public will wear it this time because they will have experienced the difficulty that they've had over this period of not having that solution. So from a practical point of view, at last, I think we're going to be addressing that.
Okay, and Wolf, bit of optimism, please.
I think it's an historic opportunity for governments across the board, regardless of their composition, to enact more inclusive socioeconomic policies, especially considering what we have seen over the last 10, 15 years. It's an historic opportunity, and I think it will be politically very acceptable to both sides of the political spectrum.
Listen, that was a fantastic call. I know that everybody who's been listening in will have really found it fascinating too. I just want to say thank you very much to our panel, Humphrey Cobbold, the CEO of Pure Gym, to David Dalton, Amber Rudd and Wolfgang Pickley. All of you were fantastic again. I should say that next week, two people that are going to be on our panel are Nicola Mendelssohn from Facebook, and we also have Francis O'Grady, who is the head of the TUC. So we've had an esteemed panel this week, and we're going to have an esteemed panel next week. I hope you'll join us, and thank you very much. See you again next Wednesday.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.